You're listening to the Tupton Children Podcast.
Good evening. Okay, let's start with our motivation. And for a moment, think of beginningless lifetimes. Try to get some sense of what it means when we say we've been cycling in samsara, going through all the different realms, having all the different experiences from beginningless lifetimes. This situation will continue like this endlessly into the future unless we cut the cause for it, unless we vanquish the ignorance that is the fundamental root of all this cycle of rebirth. So generate a strong intention to realize the nature of reality and overcome the ignorance. But seeing that all sentient beings are caught and are cycling just as we are, and have a compassionate heart that wishes to free them as well. And to do that, we have to attain full awakening. So generate the aspiration focused on full awakening for the benefit of each and every sentient being. Whether we like them or don't like them, whether they help us or harm us, let's have this bodhicitta attitude towards each one of them. So when we have this viewpoint of beginningless lifetimes and endless lifetimes, it helps us put our anger and irritation in a different perspective, because we come to see that the things we get mad at or irritated or annoyed about are things that concern only this particular lifetime. And this lifetime comes and goes very quickly. So what's the use of spending our time getting angry and annoyed, which will create more cause for more rebirths, when the time that we are experiencing right now that is annoying is actually so short compared to beginningless lives and endless lives, unless we cut the ignorance, anger, and attachment. So thinking like that can help us. You know, when anger flares up, or when greed flares up, to broaden the time frame, you know, expand the mind, take it out of this present moment in which attachment or anger is running the show, and bring the mind to a more comprehensive understanding. So then you're going to say, well, I thought Buddhists were supposed to be in the present moment, and you're telling us to get out of the present moment. Well, when your mind is overwhelmed by attachment and anger, actually, you're really not in this present moment, because you're either in the past, reliving what you had that you want again, or what you had that you don't want again, or you're in the future craving something or craving to be free of something. So you're not really in the present anyway when the mind is, you know, overwhelmed by strong craving or strong anger. Whereas when we expand our mind, you know, and take it out of that limited view of craving and anger, then it really helps us to see the big picture and to calm down. I hear some people say, "Oh, you Tibetan Buddhists, you talk about creating good karma for future life. Aren't we supposed to live in the moment? Isn't the moment the only time we live? How come you're sitting there hanging, all hung up about your future lives and creating merit for that? And your merit is only selfish. You're just trying to create merit for yourself. So you're so selfish, and you're not even in the present moment because you're thinking about future lives." I've heard that before. Okay? So we have to know how to respond to that question. Yeah, which is, you know, when the mind's overwhelmed by affliction, it's not in the present moment. And by counteracting the affliction, then we are able to bring our mind back to the present in a healthy way, rather than supposedly in the present, but our mind is actually in the past and the future. And also, you know, people creating merit for future lives, what's wrong with that? Sure, it's thinking about oneself, but it's certainly a lot better than attachment to the happiness of this life. Yeah, because sometimes when people are talking about being in this moment, what they're really meaning is completely enjoying your object of attachment. Yeah. So that's not virtuous, you know. Having a mind that wants to, let's say, be generous to create merit for a good future life is much more virtuous than the mind that is savoring every delectable moment of, you know, of attachment to having what we want. Okay? Okay, so we're going to continue where we left off before, which is we're going to be getting into the whole topic of upper rebirth and creating the cause for upper rebirth. So this motivation definitely pertains to that. So we're on stanza 4, the first two lines. Okay, here we maintain that upper rebirth is happiness, and highest good is liberation. Okay, so here Nagarjuna is explaining in brief what upper rebirth and highest good are. So upper rebirth is happiness, referring to the happiness in the mental continuums of human beings and gods. But happiness is just an example there, because when you get to the fourth concentration, the fourth jhana, or fourth dhyana, in the immaterial or in the material or form realm, there they no longer experience happiness. They experience equanimity, which is said to be much nicer than a rush of rapture and bliss. Okay, this is talking from the sutra viewpoint. So here upper rebirth is referring to happiness and equanimity that's experienced in the human realm and in the god realms. And then the highest good is liberation, so the cessation of ignorance, anger, and attachment, and the polluted karma, you know, all those things that cause rebirth. Okay. So compared to the pain in the lower realms, an upper realm is a good rebirth. You know, sure, we see a lot of human beings with incredible pain and tragedy in their lives, but that is still, considered an upper rebirth, because in general there's more happiness. And also because, especially as a human being, there's always the potential to really learn the Dharma. Yeah, we might look at our kitties and say that they experience a lot of happiness. Yeah, in fact, you may even be envious, seeing that two of them are sound asleep right now, and you'd like to be also. But, yeah, don't be envious of a cat being able to sleep, because that sleep is ignorant and very difficult for them to come out of their ignorance. Okay? And when we're talking about the highest good, you know, it's free from ignorance, which is the root affliction, all the other afflictions that create negativities, and then the polluted karma, polluted meaning created under the influence of ignorance. And this karma means action, so these actions that we've done that then ripen in terms of what we experience in our lives. Okay, so the karma that causes rebirth in cyclic existence, even as a human being or as a god, which are upper rebirths, that's still polluted karma, okay, because it's created under the influence of ignorance. Okay, Kenzo Rinpoche gives an example of what birth in samsara is like. He says it's like a person who is bound up hand and foot and put inside a very small net. Okay, so being bound is already hard enough to escape from, and put in a small net is even worse. And then you're thrown into a river at nighttime. Yeah, thrown into a river in daytime is bad enough, but at nighttime, yeah, really bad. Okay, so there's complete darkness. The darkness, you know, is the ignorance. You're pushed around by the four currents of the river, you know, of the water. This comes in the three principal aspects of the path too. So ignorance, sensual desire, craving for rebirths in samsara, and wrong views. Okay, so that's pushing us around. Being bound hand and foot is being bound by our previous karma. Yeah, in this ocean where it's dark and all these different currents are pushing us here and there. So he says that gives us some sense of what it's like to be in samsara, and liberation is freedom from that. So I think one of the things that's so difficult for us in our Dharma practice is we really don't see samsara as being so disfavorable. You know, we see samsara as being okay. That's all we've ever known. You know, yeah, we've had some suffering. We have some happiness. Things are frustrating. And we know we'll get sick and die, but we just block that out and think that maybe science will develop a pill to stop it. And so we just ignore, you know, the situation we're in, basically. Okay, so that's part of our problem, is the ignorance that keeps us trapped is the same ignorance that keeps us from seeing how bad it is to be in samsara. Yeah. Okay. And then the second two lines from the fourth verse, in brief, the method for attaining them, so upper rebirth and highest good, is summarized as faith and wisdom. Okay, so those two lines respond to the question, what are the causes? What are the causes of upper rebirth and highest good? And Nagarjuna says, in brief, they're faith and wisdom. So there's actually many causes for upper rebirth and many causes for the highest good, but if you were to abbreviate them and summarize them, they come in these two. So here, faith, yeah, refers to confidence or belief in the law of karma and its effects. Okay, so it refers to that specific kind of belief or faith in karma, the law of karma and its effects, okay? As well as the four truths of the Aryas, the three jewels, and so forth. So, you know, having faith in the basic Buddhist worldview and objects of refuge, yeah? Okay, so we start out generating belief, you know, learning what these basic teachings are and thinking about them and then developing some kind of faith or confidence that they're true. Yeah. So although we may not be able to have reliable cognizers of all of these, you know, right now, because remember last week we were talking about understanding the details of karma depends on authoritative testimony. And they have a kind of inference of authoritative testimony, but it's different than the inference by power of the fact, you know, which is what we really want to rely on. Yeah, so we study these things, we think about them, if they make sense, you know, we have faith and believe in them. Yeah, and then wisdom, yeah, so if that faith and confidence and belief in especially the law of karma and its effects, as well as the four truths and the three jewels, that helps us to attain upper rebirth. And then the wisdom that he mentioned is specifically the wisdom realizing emptiness that will help us gain the liberation, the definite good. And full awakening is also included in the definite good. It means both of them. Okay, so faith or confidence in the law of karma and its effects means that we have some understanding of the four principal aspects of karma. Okay? So first, that happiness comes from virtue, never non-virtue, and that suffering comes from non-virtue, never virtue. And that's because, you know, the Buddha looked, and when sentient beings were happy, whatever causes led to that were called virtue, and when sentient beings were miserable, the cause that led to that was called non-virtue. Okay? So virtue and non-virtue is posited with respect to the results that they bring. So things are not inherently, you know, good and bad or good and evil, and Buddha didn't make up this law or anything like that. He just described how this ethical dimension of cause and effect functions. Okay. The second quality of karma is that even a small action can bring a big result. So when we think about that, then even if we're about to tell a little white lie, we will refrain from it, knowing that it could bring a big result. And even if we're almost too lazy to do a little virtue, we will get ourselves off the off our tush, and go do the little virtue because we see that a small cause can bring a big result, in the same way that a small seed can turn into one of these huge giant trees we have around us. Yeah, it's kind of amazing when you think about that. You know, when you look at one of the big cedars we have in the forest, and you think that all started out with a seed that was this big. It's kind of amazing to think about. But, you know, something big can come from something small. The third quality of karma is that if you don't create the cause, you don't experience the result. Yeah? So, just praying to have a certain result is not good enough. We have to create the cause for it. Yeah? What was that thing about, you can pray to Allah, what is it? Something and tie your camel. What was it?
Oh, yeah.
You remember? But anyway, the whole idea is don't just pray, you've got to do something practical. Yeah. So this is your next object of distraction in your meditation session to remember what that was. I'm sure tomorrow you'll remember. Okay. But, to really see, if we don't create the cause, we can pray all we want, but it's not going to bring the result because the causal energy is missing. And then the fourth quality of karma is that our actions will definitely bring effects unless we intervene. So in the case of virtuous karma, we can impede it from ripening by getting angry or generating wrong views. In the case of non-virtuous karma, we impede it from ripening by doing purification with the four opponent powers. Okay, but if we don't do purification, then, you know, it's not like the karma is going to get lost, like our computer files get lost. Yeah. And so it's this whole thing of, you know, if you don't create the cause, you don't get the result. But if you create the cause, you're going to get the result unless you put in some kind of intervening factor. So remembering, you know, also that anger and wrong views prevent our virtuous karma from ripening. That is actually a big help to us to calm our temper down, because we don't want to waste our virtue by getting angry. Okay. So when we talk about the 10 destructive actions and the 10 constructive actions, we often say it like that. But more specifically, it's better to say that these are 10 paths of virtuous action and 10 paths of non-virtuous actions, okay? Because they're called paths of action because a path leads you into a rebirth. It's a path that takes you to a rebirth, yeah? But not all 10 are actually actions, because actions are karma, because the last 3 are actually afflictions. So, it's the 10 paths of action, but the last 3 are afflictions, they're not actions, okay? Because the last 3 are coveting, malice and wrong views, 3 mental paths of action. Okay? So to generate the faith in karma, we have to rely on the authoritative testimony of scriptures. So this doesn't mean that we just blindly believe what's ever written in a scripture, but we have to see if the scripture is reliable. Okay? So if a scripture, we test the scripture by looking at when it talks about obvious phenomena, remember the 3 kinds of phenomena, so the obvious phenomena that we can see with our senses, if what it says about obvious phenomena is correct, that's good. Okay. If it says about slightly obscure phenomena, such as subtle impermanence or emptiness, if it describes those correctly, then that's good. If it describes them incorrectly, not so good. Okay. And then the third thing is to see if the explicit and implied meanings in the scripture are concordant and free from contradiction in terms of, You know, does the scripture say one thing here and then another thing somewhere else? So if a scripture passes those three things, then in general we can trust what it says about karma. And so we learn about karma by reading those scriptures, about hearing things from our teachers, and then we think about it, and we can begin to see how it makes sense, how certain actions bring certain kind of results. You know, when you really get into studying about what the different kinds of results of the actions are, well, yeah, it makes sense that if you create the action of killing in a future life, you might live in a place with a lot of warfare, or you might have a short lifespan. Okay? It kind of makes sense. We don't see it with our eyes, but it makes sense. So we can, develop that kind of trust coming from thinking about it in that way. Okay? As well as, what we read in the different scriptures. Also, we can see that a scripture is reliable if it's taught by a reliable person. So, such as the Buddha, who, was omniscient, and also the Buddha had no reason to make up anything and no reason to lie to us. Yeah, so we can trust what the Buddha says in that respect. Okay, and then verse 5, here he's going to talk about the differences between the principal causes, faith and wisdom, and secondary causes. Okay, so verse 5 reads, because one has faith, one partakes of the Dharma. Because one has wisdom, one truly understands. Of these two, wisdom is foremost, but faith must come first. Okay, so doing to having faith in karma and its effects, then we engage in the practice of the 10 virtues, or the 10 pathways of virtue, which cause upper rebirth. Okay? And when different sentient beings have sharp faculties, then they become suitable for realizing emptiness, and they will hear the teachings on emptiness and be able to practice them and then attain, have the wisdom that realizes emptiness and attain liberation and awakening. Okay? So, the faith and wisdom realizing emptiness is the principal one, because that's the one that's going to free us from all the dukkha whatsoever. Okay? And so that's what we're really aiming for. However, before we can generate that, wisdom, because generating that wisdom is going to take some lifetimes for most of us, because we haven't done the work in previous lifetimes, so we have to, keep on going now. So although wisdom is the principal one leading to liberation, to generate that wisdom, we need a series of upper rebirths. And to get that series of upper rebirths, then we need to create the karma to do that. And to create the karma, we need to have faith in the law of cause of karma and its effects. Okay? So that's why in the verse it said, of these two, wisdom is foremost, but faith must come first. Because we have to really, practice karma, do the law of karma, due to having faith in it, in order to have that series of upper rebirths, so that we will be able, during many upper rebirths, to generate the wisdom realizing emptiness, which is the principal cause that will lead us to full awakening. Okay? So here, when we see this, we see, okay, here's the role of wisdom, here's the role of faith, but we understand why both of them are important. And that faith in karma and effects is a good start, But it alone is not going to get us to awakening. And that wisdom realizing emptiness, yes, we want that, but we also have to create the cause to get it. So to do that, we have to create a lot of virtue so that we have a good rebirth, and so that our mind stream is kind of buoyed by that virtue. You know, when our mind stream is enriched by virtue, it becomes much easier to generate wisdom. Yeah, when our mind doesn't have much virtue in it, then it's kind of like a dry desert, and not so much can grow in it. Mm-hmm. Okay, then verse 6, Nagarjuna is going to go back into an explanation of the characteristics of a person who's a suitable vessel. So we did a little bit of that at the beginning, remember, like why he's teaching the king. And so now it's kind of why, who is a vessel to generate faith, who is a vessel to generate wisdom. Okay, so verse 6 says, one who does not neglect the Dharma. In your thing it may say discover the Dharma, change it to neglect. It's an error. One who does not neglect the Dharma, first line in verse 6, change discover to neglect. And whoever has the master copy, change it to, okay? One who does not neglect the Dharma through desire, anger, fear, or confusion should be known as one with faith, a supreme vessel of the highest good. Okay? So, the previous verse said that the person with faith relies on the practices, and the person with wisdom truly knows. So then the question comes up, what does being a person with faith and a person with wisdom entail? What kind of person do you have to be to have that faith and to have that wisdom? Okay, so person with faith is someone who has confidence in the law, the causal law of karma and its effects, and due to this confidence does not go beyond the practice of virtue by engaging in non-virtuous actions, motivated by four afflictive emotions. Okay? So your instant thing, if it was like me, what do you mean four afflictive emotions? There's three poisons. Where are we getting this fourth one? Okay? So actually, it's coming from a different angle here. Okay? So these four emotions that inhibit our practice of virtue, they are mentioned in the Vinaya, in the monastic discipline. And they are partiality, which is also attachment or desire, anger, fear, and ignorance. So you'll remember, those of you who are fully ordained, especially in the Sangha Vasesas, and other categories of precepts, sometimes people get angry and they say what the Sangha is doing is unfair.
Partiality, hatred.
Partiality, anger, fear, and ignorance. Or partiality, hatred, fear, and ignorance. So partiality refers to attachment or desire, hatred and anger, fear and ignorance, okay? So to give some examples of what creating negativity motivated by these four are. So it's kind of interesting, isn't it? You know, you've been hearing the Vinaya for a long time, and now here's a reference to it, and like, okay. So let's take an example of somebody who's killing an animal, and they do it out of attachment. Okay, so they kill the animal because they want the skin and they want the meat. So that's killing done out of partiality. You know, you're craving, you're attached to something. And so you've gone beyond the practice of virtue. Yeah, then people can also kill out of anger or hatred. So that takes you beyond the practice of virtue. So, somebody is angry and mad, and what happened to, you know, our friend's daughter last week with her, you know, her ex-husband being angry and murdering her. Then fear, people can also kill out of fear. So if an example may be that somebody who has power over you orders you to kill, and out of fear of getting punished or some bad repercussion from the other person, then you kill. Or maybe you're in a very dangerous situation and, you know, you kill out of fear. Yeah, but it takes you beyond the practice of virtue. And then the last one is to kill ignorantly. And that would be, for example, doing animal sacrifice, thinking that if you sacrifice an animal, it will please the gods and benefit your family. Okay? So, you know, due to these four kind of afflictive afflictive emotions, that, excuse me, somebody's gone beyond the practice of virtue in terms of killing. So you can apply these to the other ones too. Okay. So what would it be for lying? What would lying out of partiality be? What would an example of that be?
Attachment, lying about your qualities in order to gain some sort of status or reputation.
Yeah.
So making up stuff you don't have in
them. Yeah, so lying about your qualities, putting yourself out to be somebody you aren't because of attachment to reputation or getting some kind of material offering or getting the job you want or whatever. Okay, how about anger? What's an example of lying motivated by anger?
Claiming that someone did something that they really didn't do.
Yeah.
Retaliation.
Yeah. You want to retaliate, so you make up a lie and say so-and-so did this awful thing, and you spread it around to ruin their reputation or get them in trouble. Okay. What about lying because of fear?
Saying you didn't do something when you actually did it.
Yeah, because?
You face the consequences.
Yeah, okay. So you say you didn't do something that you actually did because you're afraid of getting in trouble. And then ignorance?
Well, so telling a person on the phone that your daddy isn't home because you think it will help him.
Because you think what?
Because you think he doesn't want to be bothered. That beautiful story that Minimal Song told.
What story was that you told?
Oh, I used to tell people that my dad wasn't home because he was going to get called out to work yet again.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it was out of a wish to protect him.
So that would be more like out of attachment.
Yeah, that one would be out of attachment. Uh-huh.
So it's something that isn't true that you just don't know what is true.
Yeah.
Simply not knowing.
But, yeah, but this is like you know that you're lying. Yeah, so you know.
But how can you lie about it?
Well,
Could it be the case of someone who lies so often that they start believing their lie?
That could be, yeah. You lie so often that you forget about it, or you guess at an answer that's wrong, thinking that maybe it's right.
Could it be like if you're with a group, you don't know exactly what they're, like, say politicians, okay? You don't know politics too much, but you follow them and
Yeah, kind of ignorantly following a group of people by going along with what they say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Without really knowing, but somewhere you know, but you forgive and
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh.
What if you
lie, knowing you're lying, but you ignorantly think, oh, this is going to bring the best result.
Yeah, that's kind of what it is you know you're lying, but you think that this will bring a good result for you or for somebody else. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that like the example, the one of the teachings here, where they said somebody is going to get hurt and they run past you, and the murderer comes up to you and says, where is this person? And you lie.
Oh.
No,
that's a different situation. If somebody is chasing somebody and they want to kill them, yeah, I mean, you change the subject, you do something else. That, even if you don't tell the exact truth, that's done because you don't want somebody to get killed.
Right.
That's not done out of ignorance. It's done with a clear motivation that, you know, here's somebody who wants to kill somebody else. Somebody's going to get hurt. Somebody else is going to create negative karma. So I'm going to throw, you know, the wrench in the wheel and change the subject or say something like that. Okay? Are you getting what we're saying?
Yeah.
Okay.
Online suggests, what about lying about the climate? Because you think it would cause panic.
Oh! Yeah. Lying, oh, there's no karmic climate change or whatever it is. Yeah. That again, too, you know, you have to see if there's desire behind that. But it's more kind of lying, but ignorantly thinking it's going to be the best thing for the situation.
Someone else also suggested, what about lying, so that someone can hear what they want to hear.
Yeah. Well, sometimes that's also out of attachment or out of fear. Yeah, where you say something so somebody, you want to say it because you think that person needs to hear what they want to hear. Okay. Okay. So maybe spend some time, you know, in your meditation going through these, yeah, the partiality, anger, ignorance, fear and ignorance, and make some examples with the other ones too. Okay. So that we kind of covered that. Oh. No wonder I was on the wrong verse here. Okay. So somebody who doesn't neglect or transgress the virtuous practices due to these four emotions is a superior vessel for the highest good. Yeah? So this is somebody here, you see, somebody who does not go beyond what is virtuous due to partiality, anger, fear, or ignorance, is somebody who really has faith in the law of karma and its effects, wants to create the constructive karma that leads to good rebirth, wants not to create the destructive karma that brings bad results and that obscures their mind. So that person becomes a good vessel then to teach about the highest good, because they're already creating, they have the faith that is the first cause. They're creating the cause for a series of upper rebirths. And so then they can start learning about emptiness, yeah, so that they can generate the wisdom. So they become a good vessel. Okay, so we should remember this, you know, that somebody who keeps, good ethical conduct is the one who becomes a good vessel for the higher teachings. And you really see, you know, why it's so important to practice ethical conduct and have a foundation of virtue so that you merit receiving the higher teachings. Because if you can't get your ethical act together, even you hear the higher teachings, what kind of, how much effect will they have on your mind? Yeah. So this is what I call the stop being a jerk principle. Yeah. So when we act, in destructive ways, we're really being a jerk and we're harming ourselves. So how do we think that we can continue being a jerk and yet receive the highest teachings on this and that and actually actualize them when, you know, the simplest non-jerk actions we can't bring ourselves to do? Okay, so it makes us be a little bit more honest with ourselves here. Okay. So somebody who lacks faith in karma and its result, and that person is ignorant of what to practice and what to abandon, so such a person does not possess wisdom. Yeah, even the wisdom about, the basic wisdom about what to practice and what to abandon on the level of ethics. So that person is not suitable at that particular time to be led to liberation. They're not a suitable vessel to teach, to give the wisdom teachings to, because they're quite ignorant of what to practice and what to abandon. Okay. So in general, we say that all sentient beings can be led to awakening and they all can attain awakening, but that doesn't mean at this particular moment they all can be led to awakening and attain awakening, because as long as they have a lot of wrong views and they have very perverse actions, then they can't, you know, you can talk till you're blue in the face, and that person may even try and practice what you're talking about, but they're not going to get anywhere because they don't have just the fundamental practical wisdom about how to live their life in a good way. Okay? So we usually think of somebody, when we say somebody who's wise or somebody who's intelligent, we think of somebody who has a bunch of degrees and has a very high IQ and can do crossword puzzles very quickly and, you know, who knows what. But, you know, in actual fact, from a Buddhist viewpoint, that's not what we would call wisdom. Yeah? The wisdom we're talking about is something like the wisdom knowing about cause and effect, the wisdom knowing what to practice and abandon, the wisdom caring about our future lives. Okay? And so, you know, that a wise person is somebody who cares about and wants to learn about the practices of the individual, of the initial level being, the middle capacity being, the advanced capacity being. It's a person who cares about that and wants to learn about that. That kind of person is developing faith and also developing wisdom. Okay? Okay, so now we're going to go into, Nagarjuna is going to go into more explicitly upper rebirth and the causes of upper rebirth. Okay, so he's going to talk first about the 10 non-virtues and abandoning them. Okay, so verses 8 and 9. We did verse 7, didn't we? Oh, yeah. Okay, verse 7, a wise person is one who, having accurately analyzed all actions of body, speech, and mind, always acts for the benefit of self and others. Okay, so that's what I was saying, that person, a person who has that kind of wisdom, knows what to practice and abandon. And they're also somebody who observes their own actions, who's aware, you know, what am I doing, what am I saying, what am I thinking? Okay, and this kind of person has enthusiasm to do virtue and, you know, wants to be of benefit to others. So they, you know, they may not have actualized bodhicitta, but they think bodhicitta is wonderful. They want to develop love and compassion. They care about other sentient beings. Okay, so that kind of person is, you know, again, a proper vessel to lead to liberation and awakening. Okay, because they want to do what is good. They want to practice virtue and abandon non-virtue. Okay? They care about the practices of the initial, middle, and advanced practitioners. Okay, so now, that was verse 7. Now we're going into, you know, he's going to talk more specifically about upper rebirth and its causes. And so verse 8 and 9 about refraining from the 10 non-virtues. So they say, refraining from killing and from stealing, not engaging in adultery, restraining from lying, divisive speech, harsh words, and idle talk, abandoning covetousness, malice, and nihilistic views. These are the 10 bright paths of action. The 10 gloomy ones are their opposite. Okay? So here he's starting off talking about the 10 paths, you know, of virtuous action. So the 10 paths of virtuous action, one way is simply abandoning the 10 non-virtuous paths of action. Okay? So simply, you know, there's the opportunity to steal, you refrain from it. There's the opportunity to get mad at somebody, you refrain. Yeah, so just the refraining, the restraint of one's own behavior is a virtuous action. And what's also included in the 10 virtues is doing the opposite. So instead of killing, protecting life. Instead of stealing, protecting other, respecting others' property. Instead of sleeping around and, you know, having unwise and unkind sexual behavior, using sexuality wisely and kindly, or being celibate. Instead of lying, telling the truth. Instead of using our speech disharmoniously, creating harmony with our speech, and so on. So the opposites are also, said to be the 10 virtues. Okay, so the ten non-virtues, Vasubandhu talks about them in Treasury of Knowledge, and they're also they're explained extensively in the Lamrim text. And so I really refer you to, the Lamrim Chenmo, the great treatise on the stages of the path, the section there on karma, because there he goes into all the different parts of the action for each of the 10 actions and what, you know, is considered a full destructive action, what is considered a full constructive one, all the different results of them. It's a very extensive explanation. Okay. In general, for something to be a complete action, we say it needs to have all three branches complete. Sometimes they divided it into four branches complete, but it's just how you divide things. So the first branch is the preparation. So that it means correctly identifying the object, having the intention to do the action, having the presence of an affliction in your mind that's motivating the action. Okay, so these kinds of things are the preparation. Then the second part of having the second criteria is doing the action itself. So whatever action you plan to do, you do. And then the third is the completion of the action, which means getting the result that you set out to get. So in the case of killing, it's the person dying. In the case of stealing, it's thinking that the stuff belongs to you. So like that, you know, completing the action, getting the result you wanted, and rejoicing about that. Okay, so if you have all three of those points complete, then it becomes a complete destructive action. And a complete destructive action are the ones that are going to cause all four or all three results Okay, so they'll bring a rebirth in a certain realm, then a certain experience when we're born human, and also the tendency to do that same action again, and then the environmental result as well. And the same goes for the positive actions. You know, for it to be a complete virtuous action, you need the preparation, you know, with the intention and identifying the object correctly, and, a virtuous mental state. Then you need the action itself. Then you need the completion of the action, bringing the attainment of the result that you wanted, and also rejoicing about that. Okay, so to go through the 10 refraining or restraints quickly. Okay, so refraining from killing is abandoning taking the life of a human or an animal or an insect. Okay, refraining from stealing is not taking things that belong to others that have not been freely given to us. Okay, so we need to be careful, whether something's been freely given. The third is not engaging in unwise or unkind sexual behavior. Here, principally referring to if you're in a relationship, going outside of your relationship, or if you're not in a relationship, going with somebody who is in one. Okay. So abandoning these three is called turning our back on the three destructive physical actions. Then we have four virtuous ones of speech. So restraining from lying, so abandoning saying words that changes other people's minds to what is not true. So saying, yes, this happened when it didn't happen, or say it didn't happen when it did happen, or something like that. Then restraining, second is restraining from divisive speech. So avoiding speech that creates disharmony amongst people. So, think so-and-so said this about you, so-and-so said that. Did you hear what so-and-so did? You're going to be on my side, aren't you? Because so-and-so's such a jerk. Look what they did to me. This kind of stuff is really easy to create, especially when we're upset. We want to tell everybody else how nasty somebody was and get them all on our side. So it becomes harsh words, so we want to abandon that kind of divisive. It becomes divisive speech, so we want to abandon that. Then the next one, the sixth one, is restraining from harsh speech. So that's abandoning speech that hurts other people's feelings. So yelling, screaming, ridiculing, making fun of, things like that. The seventh one is restraining from idle talk. So that's speech. Stopping speech that is about nothing, that has no meaning. Yeah, that's just frivolous talk. And then the three that are, pathways of actions but are afflictions. So abandoning coveting, so means abandoning looking at the possessions of others and thinking how fantastic it would be if I could have them. Okay, so coveting is exactly why they want us to go to the shopping mall, so we can covet as much as we want, and it's good for the economy to encourage people to covet, and use more than our share of the world's resources. So many downfalls, resulting from coveting. Okay, abandoning malice is giving up planning how to harm somebody's body or their possessions. Yeah. And then abandoning nihilistic views is relinquishing wrong views that negate the existence of things that are important. So saying there's no law of karma and its effects, there's no three jewels, the four noble truths are nonsense, they don't exist, this kind of thing. Okay. So if we seek upper rebirth, then we should definitely practice restraining ourselves from those 10. Okay, there's more to come, but I think we're going to have to wait until next week for that. Questions so far? Yeah.
Is wishing someone else harm, even though you're not really planning to cause that? That's
is wishing somebody else harm maliciousness? If it's just a random thought that passes through and we don't follow it, that's just a thought of anger. But when the thought comes and we go, oh yeah, it'd be nice if that person had a taste of their own medicine. You know, it might really put them in their place and teach them something. Or I hope my competitor, in whatever business I'm doing, I hope they get busted for whatever, thing they do. Or maybe they'll get sick developing a malicious thought is that one. Yeah. If it just passes through and you don't grab it, then it's just anger. It comes and goes.
Mm-hmm. At one point you were saying, due to having faith in karma and its effects, then we engage in the 10 pathways. I was just thinking in my own experience, the 10 pathways, engaging in avoiding the destructive actions just makes initially common sense.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of like the motivating factor.
Yeah.
My understanding of karma was, tiny.
Yeah.
So I guess it goes back and forth, right?
Yeah. So what you're saying is like some people, at the beginning, their motivation to abandon some of the negative actions isn't because they have faith in karma. It's because it just makes sense to abandon acting like that. Is that what you're saying? Yeah. And I think that that's still virtuous. Yeah. Because I think somehow we did learn somewhere along the line, even if it was from a different religion that we grew up in, that these actions are things that harm other living beings, and we care, about other living beings. So maybe we're not thinking about the karmic result for ourselves, but we are thinking about the feelings of others, and we restrain harming others because we care about their feelings. That's definitely still virtuous. Yes?
Yeah. Question about the lying one that I forgot until you mentioned it again, that the other person has to believe you.
Yeah.
For it to be complete.
Right.
But still, you're lying, even if they don't believe you, right?
Yeah. But it's not a complete action of lying if they don't believe you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But this is the reason why they say we have to be careful about joking or mm-hmm. saying things for a prank, because sometimes people do believe it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
With it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
Doesn't necessarily have to be a complete action to be a negative action.
To be a complete negative action, you need all those branches. If you only have one, two, or two of the branches, it's not a complete one, so it's not going to bring all the results, but it's still negative, yeah.
It still brings some negative results.
Yeah, but not, it won't bring all of the results that it does if all the points are correct, are complete.
Sometimes it just gets you getting into more and more of the habit of thinking like that, or doing like that.
Yeah.
The habit one is the one that I always find that, even if it's just a passing nasty thought about somebody that I catch,
mm-hmm.
it's still a habit of that thing coming up under certain circumstances.
Yeah.
And I'm not doing something about that except trying to work with it, but it's still there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When an action is incomplete or a fleeting thought, should we still purify right away?
What do you think? What's going to happen if you purify right away, and what's going to happen if you don't purify right away?
The karma will be lessened or go away if you purify right away, whereas it will just keep growing if you don't purify it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so it will keep growing if you don't purify right away, and it will, you know, you'll catch it in, you know, when it starts, if you do purify. It's like when the knapweed comes, you know. Is it better to pick the knapweed when it's small or to wait a month until it's really big and it's grown and it has the flowers on it, and then you pick it? Yeah. Or do whatever. Okay. That question sounds like somebody's trying to maybe negotiate.
I want to do it first, and then I'll think bad, feel badly about it, and then I'll purify after I've done it.
Yeah.
It just popped into my head, if we do virtuous actions, but we don't kind of acknowledge them, or we're not aware of them, how does that affect that virtue?
Well, you know, it for all of these, the completion, it doesn't necessarily mean you have to have the very conscious thought of, you know, either, oh, I'm glad that guy's dead now, or, oh, I'm glad that somebody has something. But it can just be your general attitude, how you feel about what happened. I mean, of course, if you have that conscious thought, that's going to be a lot clearer. But if it's just your general attitude about, you know, oh, I made offerings to the three jewels, I feel good, that's nice. Yeah. But that's also why it's important to rejoice about our own virtue and to dedicate our own virtue.
And the result of that then is that we progress not faster, but commensurate with the virtue we're creating.
Yeah.
If we don't, then it's kind of, would it be kind of a slower process?
Well, can you make an example for me?
No. This is not quite out well.
Yeah. Maybe think about what an example would be. Okay. Okay, well, you're thinking, what?
I'm kind of adding, if you don't recognize your own virtue, first of all, you might not recognize the virtues of others, so you have less virtues and others' virtues.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, very important to recognize our own and others' virtues. I mean, there can be some things that, where we act virtuously just kind of automatically without thinking about it so much. This is just what you do because you're in a habit of doing it. So, you know, I mean, that creates merit. I don't think every 5 minutes you have to say, oh, I'm really glad, I rejoice I didn't lie in the last 5 minutes. Yeah.
I think where this is coming from is kind of the opposite. If you have the habit of focusing on the negative so much, and you kind of dismiss or don't even acknowledge your virtue.
Your virtue, yes.
And it keeps you stuck in the negative.
Yeah, that's true.
I think it's that.
Yeah, yeah. So if you're operating on a self-critical mode of I did this wrong and I did that wrong and I did the other thing wrong, to the point where you don't even notice your own virtue and rejoice at it, then that keeps you really kind of stuck and limited. Yeah? You may be creating some virtue, but it would be, if you rejoiced in your own virtue and dedicated it, it would be greater, you know, and more stable than if you're always, well, yeah, I did something nice, but I could have done more. Yeah, that kind of thing.
One part where I have difficulty is the little things of daily life, like eating, washing yourself, to turn that into virtue, I have difficulty.
Yeah.
When I offer that, when I think about offering it.
Yeah. So this is part of our thought training practice, you know, practicing those short gathas and ways of thinking to transform neutral actions into virtue. So it's just something that we train our mind with, and as we do it more, then we feel more joyful doing it.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me of some conversations I've had with my dad where I'm trying to tell him to rejoice that he's had an ethical life. And he'll always say, this is, but he'll always look at me like, this is no big deal. Isn't this basic manners? You know, I'm trying to cultivate a positive, you know, like you've done good in your life. This is something to be about.
Yeah. Well, he tends to be rather humble about it, mm-hmm. maybe. Uh-huh.
So if, say, something comes up and you're tempted to lie for a benefit or something, a temporary benefit, but not even tempted, just the opportunity is there and you don't do it because you just, you know, lie. Mm-hmm. But if you are already holding a precept, that is the preparation stage for that, right? I mean, say something comes up and I could, where I could lie to somebody and mm-hmm. get more change at the grocery store or something.
Yeah.
But I don't even really think about it. I don't do it. Because of,
right.
But if I'm already holding a precept not to lie, that already fulfills the
yeah.
preparation one. Even
right.
I'm not
if you
have conscious of it.
Exactly.
Moment.
Exactly. If you hold the precept, the determination was created when you took the precept. And that determination to not lie or whatever it is still in effect at that moment. You know, even though you're not saying to yourself, oh, look how good I am, I'm not lying because they gave me too much change. You just do it automatically. Yeah.
So that is part of what makes holding precepts makes the virtue stronger.
Yeah.
Because it's fulfilling that.
Right. Yeah. Whereas, you know, two people, I mean, I always use the example, two people may be sitting in the room. One has the precept not to kill. One doesn't have the precept, but neither one of them are killing at this moment. One is not creating any karma because they have no intention to abandon killing at this moment. The other one is creating the virtue of not killing, you know, because they took the precept, and that intention is still working in their mind.
Hmm? And that's happening constantly.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Every moment.
Even when you're sleeping.
Right. Yeah. Okay. I think just as a quick comment, just calling these 10 paths of virtuous action or 10 paths of has a very good effect on my mind. You know, this, as you said, it's leading to certain kind of rebirth.
Uh-huh.
So it's like, you know, hello. Pay attention.
Yeah. So you're saying calling them paths of action really helps you remember one of the reasons why we're abandoning them is because they're leading to the negative, or in the case of the virtuous ones, they're leading to a good rebirth. So it reminds us. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Okay.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losong's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting those teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the west floor.